Welcome to Military History Inside Out, a podcast devoted to the study of how war has been waged across the centuries. Hello. In today's podcast, I speak with author Trent Hone about his book Learning War, which is about the evolution of the U.S. Navy's fighting doctrine from 1898 to 1945. Obviously, since we talk about those periods, we discuss doctrine up to and through World War One, and then we spend a fair amount of time on doctrine applied in World War Two. We get into naval aviation, surface warfare, a little bit into submarine warfare. We compare some of the U.S. Navy's actions and thinking to other countries. We talk about the General Board, the evolution of the U.S. Naval Academy in this period. A lot of interesting things. I hope you enjoy. Thank you. I'm speaking with Trent Hone, author of Learning War, The Evolution of Fighting Doctrine in the U.S. Navy, 1898 to 1945. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me first about your background in writing and in history.
Sure. So I've been looking into naval history subjects for quite a long time. The first bit that I had published was about 15 years ago. It was a piece in the Journal of Military History that looked at how the United States Navy was planning to fight a battle line engagement for the start of the Second World War. But I've been very interested in history and naval history in particular for many years before that. I was reading as much as I could get my hands on, studying the design and the development of naval ships and playing a variety of different either tabletop or chip-based war games from about the time that I could do addition and subtraction. So that was a lot of fun.
So it sounds like you've always wanted to write a book on this subject.
Well, I don't know that I've always wanted to write a book. A book always seemed like a large and intimidating thing. Certainly I was interested in it, but it wasn't until I had enough, let's say, research and practice under my belt that I felt like I could attempt pulling a lot of the threads that I've been working on together into a book. And so that was something that just happened over the past, let's say, 4 years or so.
Mm-hmm. And so what is it you were doing that sort of prepared, what sort of writing or did you do to prepare?
Oh, I was, prior to the book and the work on the book, I had written a number of different things. So I mentioned that article from the Journal of Military History. There were a couple other articles that built on that research. One looked at night combat in the U.S. Navy in the early years of World War II. Another one looked at how the Navy's doctrinal development changed over the course of the war. That was published in the Naval War College Review. And I began to become familiar with other historians and collaborated on a number of different projects. So there was a book called On Seas Contested, which looked at the different navies of the Second World War. And I wrote a chapter in that on the United States Navy. And there was another one, I think it was called To Crown the Waves, that did the same thing for World War One. Mm-hmm. And I also wrote the U.S. history on that one. Yes, To Crown the Waves, The Great Navies of the First World War. Mm-hmm. That was his name.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about this book.
This book, I'm really excited about this book, because not only does it look at the history of the United States Navy's tactical doctrine in the early years of the 20th century, you know, in the arc from the end of the Spanish-American War through the end of World War II, but I make the argument that the U.S. Navy developed what today we often call a learning system, or became a learning organization. That is, they were very receptive to new ideas, new technologies, and found ways to explore the opportunities available with them and then exploit them relatively rapidly. There's a lot of literature that looks at how the U.S. Navy did that in the interwar period between World War One and World War Two, with regards to naval aviation. But what I try to show is that if we look at this in a longer time scale, before the introduction of the airplane, the foundation for that innovative practice was established many years earlier. And by looking at surface warfare tactics and doctrine, I think I present a broader picture of the U.S. Navy's innovative techniques and approaches over the first half of the 20th century.
Was it, did you find it primarily personality driven, or was it structurally?
That's a lovely question, because one of the things that I see, or we could find in a lot of the established literature, is there's an emphasis on the personalities. So let's look, take the figure of William S. Sims, for example. Often he's cited as an innovator, someone who had to fight against institutionalized practice that wasn't very effective and change the paradigm. Most famously for the introduction of the Navy system of fire control in the years before World War One. And it's true that Sims is very influential, and he's very a very important figure, but he's working against this backdrop, or I should say with this backdrop of other individuals who often receive less credit, who are granting him the freedom to operate in the way that he became famous for. So, he's got a relationship with President Roosevelt, who gives him a little leeway. There's some opportunity there, but also within the Navy itself. So, the chief of the Bureau of Navigation at the time that Sims was appointed to be director of target practice is a man named Henry Clay Taylor. And he put Sims in that role, and he is interested in the kind of work that Sims wants to do. So it's a story of individual drive coupled with institutional changes and an institutional framework that allows these kinds of things to happen. And I try to chart that history in the book.
So why did you start with the end of the Spanish-American War? What happened there that...
Well, it seems a good point of departure for a number of different reasons. It's in that mix, in the experience of the Spanish-American War, that the Navy recognizes that it needs a new institutional structure, the a board or an organization that can understand and formulate the strategy and how the Navy is going to execute on that in terms of its force structure and organization and other things. And so that leads to the creation of the General Board soon after that conflict is over. And so that was an important moment. Another one is the fact that there's been a lot of tension in the decades leading up to that moment about the relationship of engineering officers and line officers within the fleet. Engineering officers are not treated as line officers. They're a separate organization. And soon after the Spanish-American War, that comes to a head as well. And there's a determination made that to command the modern ships that are now equipping the United States Navy, line officers have to have engineering knowledge. And engineering officers, those who are young enough, should be accorded the opportunity to become line officers if they wish to do so. And that marks the beginning of Annapolis, the Naval Academy, as an engineering school. Mm. Part of that, that wasn't its focus. And those two things create a new paradigm that first allows the Navy to begin to learn a bit more systematically from the introduction of engineering and scientific approaches at the Naval Academy. And then second, an institutional basis for looking at how it's going about its business and making it better. And that latter is the General Board.
So I think after the Spanish-American War, didn't the U.S. pretty much gain sort of an overseas empire, so to speak, and did that spur the Navy to worry more about how are they going to protect these territories?
Yes, yes, excellent. That is another important construct, right? So after the Spanish-American War, the United States becomes a global power. The acquisition of the Philippines pulls the Navy's attention farther towards the Western Pacific. The Western Atlantic has already been a focus area, but obviously with the acquisition of Puerto Rico and the oversight of Cuba that goes on, and the interaction with some of the other island nations there in the Caribbean, the Navy develops a broader outward view, right? And then Hawaii is acquired in a similar time scale as well. So there are greater international commitments that the Navy has to think about how it's going to maintain.
Was the Navy happy about this, or did the Navy feel this was too much for it to have to, you know, did it want the U.S. to have an empire?
that's a good question. I am not sure that the Navy wanted the United States to have an empire, but certainly that's one of the first things that the General Board begins to think seriously about. What should the Navy look like given these commitments and obligations? You know, and there's a lot of thinking that goes into what the fleet ought to be. There's reluctance to build to anywhere near, you know, the number of ships that the General Board was interested in, right? They wanted a fleet of 48 battleships, but they Congress wasn't going to approve that, but the growth of the fleet is pretty rapid, and it's imbued with a lot of the writings and theorizing of Alfred Thayer Mahan, who most people have heard of, right? Mm-hmm. So he's a very influential figure, talked about the importance of sea power, and in large part in an effort to try to get a stronger, more professional Navy to allow the United States to become more dominant in the world than it had been.
Mm-hmm. What was the composition of the General Board when it was first convened? You know, not necessarily persons, but what positions, you know, filled its ranks?
I'd have to look to get a detailed view, but I know that, you know, Dewey, Admiral Dewey, is one of the more senior leaders in the Navy, is there. The head of the Office of Naval Intelligence is there. The head of the Bureau of Navigation, who was responsible for personnel matters. And there are a variety of others, but I do not remember the specific composition off the top of my head.
Now, how did the General Board get its findings, you know, to the head of the Navy and then from there to the head of the U.S. government?
Well, it's formed by Secretary of the Navy, John Davis Long, and he's apprehensive about the idea, as many are other naval secretaries were, about having an organization that could somehow exercise command authority and then undermine civilian authority. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, the United States is a republic. Mm-hmm. Civilian authority over the military is enshrined into our institutions, and they didn't want any intermediary there that might prevent civilian control. So what Long does is he says, all right, the board only has an advisory function. It can't command anything. So it can advise me as the Secretary of the Navy, and then the officers who are in charge of the Navy's technical bureaus, like the Bureau of Ordnance or the Bureau of Engineering, on how they should operate. And so it becomes this mechanism for reviewing how things are working and sort of injecting concepts and ideas from the side. Mm-hmm. Many naval officers think that this is a good step, but that it's inadequate to really allow the Navy to do the things that it needs to do. So for the intervening years, basically a decade and a half, there's drive to introduce an official, you know, general staff function, either to make the general board such that it has greater authority so that it can actually command, or to introduce a new mechanism. And ultimately, that leads to the introduction of the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations, which becomes a very American approach to that challenge. Right? Because again, it is intended to collaborate with civilian authority, not override it.
So what happened, so with World War One, I guess that's the first big test of what they've been able to accomplish. What do you see happen?
World War One is very interesting. I think there are some really important things that happened before it.
Okay.
So from a surface tactics perspective, there are two really important things that happen before the Americans enter World War One. The first is the establishment of the Atlantic Fleet, which President Roosevelt sends around the world as the Great White Fleet in 1907. Prior to that, there was no American fleet. There were distributed formations in squadrons. So it was very difficult to bring a formation of ships together and actually practice large evolutions and prepare for naval combat at any significant scale. The Atlantic Fleet changes that. They begin to practice. They begin to work out or work through some of the challenges of handling a fleet at sea. And some of the most effective experimentation is done by the torpedo flotilla of the Atlantic Fleet. And I think some of this has to do with the fact that a lot of the officers, the commanding officers of these destroyers, mostly destroyers in the torpedo flotilla. There are also submarines, but a lot of the most important work was done in destroyers. They're relatively young. They've come through the new educational system. So, you know, they've been trained as engineering officers. They have that background, as well as command line officers. And they try out new techniques and new ideas under the tutelage or guidance of Sims again, because he becomes commander of the Atlantic Fleet's torpedo flotilla in 1913, having just come from the Naval War College, where he learned a great deal about how to formulate command and orders in a collaborative way. And so he brings that mechanism to these young officers and gets them to think about how they're going to work together in the tactical exercises. And in essence, what they do is they create the U.S. Navy's first tactical doctrine, guidance for how to work together in a distributed formation without real-time instructions towards a common goal. Now, you asked about World War One. What happens in World War One? Sims, as many people know, goes off to liaise with the British and the Royal Navy before America enters the war. Once America enters the war, he ultimately becomes commander of American naval forces in Europe. And he takes this concept of doctrine with him. And the ships that are working against the submarines there in Europe trial these approaches more broadly under Sims' direction and gain a lot of experience about how it can be effective. So what I would say is this approach is prototyped in the Atlantic Fleet before the war, and then, based on experience during the war, begins to become the standard mechanism in the United States Navy.
Was World War One for the U.S. Navy, was it basically defending against U-boats, or was there any much offensive action as far as, you know?
Yeah, another excellent question. So they had assumed, right, a lot of the thinking is that they're, you know, we need to prepare for major fleet action. That's the threat. That's the challenge. And so, the end of the war, that's not really the threat. You know, by 1917, the Germans are hesitant to expose their fleet to significant loss in the North Atlantic. And so instead, they try to win the war as best they can by isolating Britain through U-boats. And the U.S. Navy is not well prepared for that, because this is a paradigm that they hadn't prepared for.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a rush to build the kinds of ships that are available or that are effective against U-boats. You know, there's a massive number of destroyers that are built to the new, larger designs, and there are other smaller ships that are of questionable utility, but a lot of them are built, and that's what the U.S. Navy tries to do. There's also an amazing investment in the North Sea mine barrage, which the Bureau of Ordnance was quite proud of because it involved these very sophisticated magnetic mines, or electromagnetic, I should say. But there's uncertainty about how effective that actually was.
Hmm. So then after the war, did the Navy look at itself and decide, well, we didn't quite get right how the war would progress? You know, how do we change our way of thinking? Was there anything like that?
There is, to an extent. What I cover in a bit more detail in the book is how that thread about doctrinal development that was experimented with before the war and then proved successful during the war becomes the basis for how the Navy begins to develop tactical doctrine through the course of the interwar period.
Okay.
But there's also a general sense that there's a lot of different options now for how a fleet could fight.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So before World War One, there's a lot of focus on the battle fleet, battleships. Starting in 1916, as the torpedo flotilla begins to become more effective, there's a recognition that, you know, torpedoes on destroyers can be a really powerful weapon of war, and we can't just assume battleships are going to be the decisive arm. We've got to figure out how to use these things together. That expands even further in the interwar period. So there's a consideration of, you know, aircraft. How are we going to use airplanes? What purpose do they need to serve in the fleet? Are they just scouts? Or can they be effective at attacking as well? You know, and ultimately, once the Lexington and Saratoga, the large new carriers, join the fleet, there becomes a strong sense that they can be effective offensive weapons. Submarines get fit in with the fleet. There is a lot of uncertainty as to exactly what role they're going to play. I don't discuss that a great deal, but if you look at the records of the fleet problems, it's clear that there's a recognition it's going to be problematic to use them closely with the fleet. It's too difficult to coordinate. There's also a recognition that it's difficult to attack a well-protected fleet with a submarine. And you get the sense from looking at the records that although it's illegal to operate as the Germans did, mm-hmm. and to sink, you know, to employ unrestricted warfare against commerce, that most of the submarine officers have in the back of their minds that, well, if the gloves come off, that's a good way to use these boats.
Right.
But we can't really talk about that, because that's illegal right now.
and I'm kind of skipping ahead to World War II, you know, it's often said, or I've often heard or read, that, you know, everyone still thought battleships were the way that World War II would be fought. You know, not just the U.S., I think Japan kind of felt that way. Was the Navy General Board, were they sort of that mind before World War II, or was this more the civilian government, or, you know, who was figuring out how World War II might be fought, or a future war?
You're touching on something which has been a pervasive belief for a long time. Mm-hmm. And that is, it gets into a couple different things. But so if you look at the records of the fleet problems, the plans and studies that the Navy had in the interwar period, how they're thinking about fighting an upcoming war, and a lot of this detailed thinking is not in the sphere of the General Board so much as in the sphere of the fleet commanders and their subordinates. And because there are war games that either simulate or repeat or modify the Battle of Jutland in some way, there is a belief that, well, the Navy was looking backward. It planned to fight a large fleet engagement like the Battle of Jutland, the large action in 1916 between the Germans and the British in World War I, they weren't really anticipating the impact of new technologies and weren't forward-looking. And this narrative is usually tied to something that's been called the Gun Club, which are the sort of battleship-oriented admirals who emphasized surface gunfire as the way to win a fleet action. The historical record is a lot more nuanced than that view. And I think what's come down to us is an unfortunate filtering, because the successful high-level officers in the Navy, meaning the ones who did well in these fleet problems and the ones who got promoted to the highest levels of command, were the ones who were open to new approaches to leveraging all the different combat weapons within the fleet. So to be at those highest levels, you had to be effective not only at using the battleships of the battle fleet, but also aircraft carriers, also cruisers and destroyers, and to some extent the submarines. So there's more diversity of thought in terms of how a fleet action would be fought and won than generally is recognized. I try to make that point in the book. Mm-hmm. What it leads to is an assumption that there will be a campaign in the Pacific. We expect the campaign is going to end, or at least climax, in a decisive battle. But because it's a campaign, because we're going to have to cross some length of the Pacific before the Japanese would be willing to fight, they're going to try to whittle down our strength as we go. We don't know what they're going to whittle. So they may be very successful at sinking some percentage of the battleships. They may be successful at sinking cruisers. They may damage aircraft carriers. So the fleet commanders begin to develop this mental frame that they're not going to know for sure what ships they'll have left. And therefore, they have to be practiced at using whatever is available. If they've got a preponderance of destroyers, they have to figure out how to leverage that. If they've got more battleships than the Japanese, they have to figure out how to leverage that. If they've got both, they need to figure out how to combine them. And so there's a lot more flexibility to the thinking than most people have been led to believe.
So it sounds like during this period that the Navy promoted for merit more than patronage, or, you know, who was friends with who.
Generally speaking, I would say yes. Because there are certainly examples of officers who did not perform well in the fleet problems who either their career effectively ended or they were, you know, shuffled off to do something else. But I think also that you can trace sort of levels of, I don't want to call it sponsorship, that seems quite the wrong word, but there are sort of affiliations that you can observe. You know, people who have become close to, you know, someone else, and that someone else does well, and then therefore, you know, there is some of that patronage, I would say. But I don't think it's biased against performance. The two go together to bring up some of the most skilled officers.
So, just so having listened to everything you've said, it seems that by embracing sort of the industrial and engineering aspect of warfare that it was becoming, that the Navy was able to succeed to some extent.
I think that they became much more effective at thinking systematically about the options that were available and developing routines to get feedback about what was working and what wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the fleet problems, I've mentioned this a couple of times. Those were the large exercises that took place practically every year through the course of the interwar period. They were the culmination of an annual training regimen. And they're really valuable from a historical perspective because they provide a lot of insight into what the Navy was doing. But they were also extremely valuable at the time because they're contested exercises. Right? You've got one section of the fleet effectively fighting the other one in an operational level problem. And there's a lot of freedom. Each side is given a mission and an objective, but in terms of how that's accomplished, they have a lot of flexibility. So they're testing the capabilities of the various ship types and the officers commanding them to see what works. And one of the things that's really neat when you look into them is there's a lot of creativity that goes on. Different officers try different things. And so the most effective techniques, because there's an honest assessment of how these are working, generally bubble to the top. And there's a continual refinement of the approach.
So what are the resources you used to do your research for this book?
Well, it started years ago looking at records of sleep problems. What was the situation? What were the various orders created by both sides? How did they play out? And then at the end of most of these, there's an assessment. The officers get together and talk about what happened and share the lessons that they've got. So that was one of the key things that I looked at. Also spent a lot of time looking at the associated doctrinal manuals because there are ones that go back earlier, but the first official ones are the ones created immediately after World War I. What's in those? What do they say? And how do they get revised and refined over the course of the interwar period and then into World War II? So those are really valuable. One of the things that's sometimes frustrating about them, though, is they have a wealth of information, but they don't have a lot of context. Right? It's like if you were to go and read a professional football team's playbook, you'd learn something about how they do it, but you wouldn't understand how they interpret those plays based on the course of action on the field.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other thing that you've got to do is look back into records about how were those formulated. What was the correspondence back and forth about the document when it was first issued or before it was issued and it was being put together? Who worked on it? Who issued it? When did that happen? So there's a whole level of context that has to go along with those things, and looking at the exercises that were employed to sort of test some of those manuals or that led to the manuals as well. Also spent a lot of time looking at annual reports from the Secretary of the Navy and, you know, all the other reports that get filled into that, like the reports of the Bureau of Chiefs and the other arms of the administrative organization associated with the Navy. There's a lot of detail in there. One of the major chapters in the book is on the development of the Navy's fire control system in the years before and during World War I. And there's a lot of material there, some of it which is in some secondary sources. That's quite good. So I pulled from a balance of secondary sources and also primary sources associated with that. Lots of things.
So where do you find most of your primary sources? What archives?
the two archives I made the most use of are the National Archives. Now it's got two different locations, the one in College Park and the one downtown in D.C. And then the other archives is the War College Archives in Newport. They have a lot of the early material about how different tactical problems were getting conceptualized and then worked out, first on the game board and then in the Atlantic Fleet after 1907. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of valuable material there.
So what part of the research was most enjoyable?
Oh, that's a great question. I think some of that stuff at the War College was most enjoyable because one of the things that was really interesting to me is, so I started looking at the interwar period as a way to learn more about what happened in the Second World War. And that's really valuable context. But then I discovered I had to go back farther. To understand what's going on in the interwar period, got to look at World War One. And, oh, gee, World War One didn't last very long, so a lot of the things that were important to the early interwar period happened before World War One. And, you know, before you know it, you're looking at stuff from, you know, 1900 or 1898, and that's the thing that you need, because that's where a lot of this foundational thinking was conceptualized.
You reminded me of a question I had. So you had mentioned the Navy's development of nighttime fighting, and that it made me think of how in World War II, the U.S. Army's Air Force had to, they wanted to do nighttime bombing over Europe. The British wouldn't do it, so the U.S. said, well, we're going to go ahead and perfect it and do it ourselves then, if you won't. So I'm curious if the Navy and the Air Force ever combined, you know, thought about it the same way, or did they develop it separately, nighttime fighting?
I think a lot of that is probably separate. I haven't looked at what the Air Force did. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I thought was fascinating, some listeners may know that PBYs were used at night in World War II. Those are the patrol planes, the Catalinas, and often with rare equipment. I didn't realize that there was a whole series of approaches about trying to get patrol planes and surface ships to interact and collaborate before the war, you know, even at night. So that wartime success, I would argue, because it was successful in a number of different instances, was built on, you know, pre-war experiences. Radar makes it much more effective because then the plane has eyes that it never would have had without it. But the concept of operating airplanes and surface ships together at night was not new in World War II. Something that they had been thinking about for some time.
Mm-hmm. What spurred that, you know, obviously it's dangerous to try to operate at night. What might have spurred that? Was that just part of the, hey, let's think of what could be out there?
This is a great piece, I think, because there's a lot of night surface fighting with the Japanese in World War II. The Japanese very deliberately prepared for it and saw night combat as either an equalizer or a force multiplier, but depending on how strongly you want to view their approaches. And the impression that's come down to us is that, the U.S. Navy wasn't prepared for this sort of thing because it had a larger fleet. It was more conditioned to fight in the daylight when you could leverage that greater force. What I think is fascinating is that even dating back to that pre-World War One work in the torpedo flotilla, there was a concept of what the Navy called the night search and attack. Basically, we will get destroyers together and, you know, spread out on a patrol line, try to find the enemy's main body, which then meant, you know, the battleships at the center of their fleet formation, and we're going to attack them. And this was how pre-World War One, the Navy thought destroyers could be extremely effective as an offensive weapon. And so practice with that recurs up to World War One, through the interwar period, and leading into World War Two. So there was this foundation of thinking, you know, we can use destroyers at night, we can be successful with this. But it morphs and it changes in the interwar period a bit. And the thing that's a bit surprising about it is, at first, right, one of the great capabilities a small destroyer has, these very old destroyers, is they're small, they're hard to see at night, so they can use stealth. And that's what they tried to do in the exercises. In the interwar period, the destroyers get bigger. And in the fleet exercises, they learn, well, to get to a battleship, to get to close range, to launch torpedoes, we have to get through a screen. Yeah, so there will be enemy screening vessels. Those might be destroyers or cruisers or something that are going to interfere with our ability to close the battleships.
Mm-hmm.
And because the mentality was we should save the torpedoes, because we only have so many on each destroyer, to save the torpedoes from the most valuable targets, the enemy battleships. So to get through the screen, what we're going to do is we're going to shoot our way through. And, you know, it's probably obvious to listeners at this point, well, if you're shooting your way through something, you're not stealthy anymore.
Right.
So the destroyer's practice, it abandons this idea of a stealthy firing of torpedoes so that they can get close enough to launch them at the battleships and fight their way through the screen. So the paradigm changes a good bit in, say, the 25 years between, you know, 1916 and 1941. The Japanese retain that idea of stealth. And so their nocturnal torpedo attacks early in the war are much more effective and much different from what the U.S. Navy had been practicing.
Mm-hmm. What did you find that was most surprising in your research?
I was really surprised at how far back the foundations of some of this stuff goes. I thought that I would find the most innovation and learning in the interwar period because I had been somewhat familiar with that. There was the established narrative of the introduction of naval aviation as a real decisive force. So I thought there was something special about the interwar period that lent itself to the introduction of new capabilities. I didn't expect to find that went farther back, and that it starts around the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm. So what was the most difficult part to research? Is there something that you still haven't solve the question that you want to get at, or something that you did solve, but it just took a lot of effort?
Well, I think what I would like to spend more time doing, I did some of it for certain individuals, but to do more about how important are the different connections between different officers and the spheres of influence that they had. You know, some seem to be the not inspiration, but sort of they develop a bit of a following. Right, so Sims is very important. I've mentioned him a couple times. William Pratt is another one who's really important. The two of them worked together. And there are others who have this, you know, important lineage. But I think tracing those connections in a bit more detail would be something valuable I could follow onto this or augment it.
Was there anything you discovered that sort of emotionally moved you in some way, something that really bothered you or that really made you happy or upset?
One of the things that I've woven into this that built on some research that I had done before about night combat early in the Second World War is a close and detailed look at the night surface action, early morning on Friday, November 13th, 1942. This is where Daniel Callahan and Norman Scott take a mixed task force into Iron Bottom Sound off Guadalcanal and fight a Japanese bombardment group that's got two battleships and it's escorting forces. One of the things that I think is important to recognize with that is that I believe Callahan, as the commander, had a better sense of what he was trying to do than most histories have suggested. I found a piece in the Naval War College archives that charted fighting strength ratios at various ranges between, it compared two American treaty cruisers against one of those Japanese fast battleships, and also three American treaty cruisers against one of those fast battleships. Now, the treaty cruisers are cruisers that were built under the treaty regime that held for most of the interwar period. Mm-hmm. Callahan had three of those ships, the San Francisco, the Portland, and the Helena. And if you look at those fighting strength comparisons, it becomes very obvious that the way the Navy was thinking about beating one of those Japanese battleships was to get to close range with two or three of these ships. Because at longer ranges, the Japanese, the larger guns are just more powerful. But at close range, the cruisers can fire faster and can overwhelm, at least according to the analysis that they were performing, potentially overwhelm the battleships. So when I found that, his tactics made a lot more sense. Because what he does in the battle is he tries to get close with his cruisers. And from what survives of the TBS logs, it's very apparent that even though it's a very confusing and desperate situation, he's trying to get his ships close. And he's trying to lead them from his flagship, San Francisco, you know, a follow the leader kind of thing, let's go get them. And so that makes me emotional when I think about it, because there's an answer to what has appeared to be for many years just a confused officer who was overwhelmed by the situation. But I think he had a better handle on it than most of us have suggested. But it's hard to say definitively because he was killed very soon thereafter. I feel like I'm doing him some justice that he hasn't seen before.
Yeah, interesting. So what do you hope the book will do in the field of U.S. naval history or just U.S. military history in general?
I hope it sparks a more serious conversation about how to keep doctrine flexible and innovative. Because one of the things that I think is key to the success of the United States Navy over this period, and particularly in the Second World War, was its ability to adapt, adjust, and evolve its tactical approaches. So how it went about fighting. It learns, the U.S. Navy learns faster than the Japanese did. And I think that, to a large extent, explains the rapid success that comes starting in 1943. I feel like oftentimes we are too rigid with our concept of how doctrine should be formulated and disseminated and then modified. And I think that the book gives a good sense of the importance of retaining agility when it comes to doctrine.
It also makes me wonder, you know, with the Navy, you know, platforms require a great deal of investment and time to build. It seems that this flexibility also requires the industrial base to be flexible as well, and the Navy should be tied in with them. Did you see anything like that?
That's a really good point. One of the things that I think is interesting, the battleships anyway are fairly long-lived platforms, right? So the Navy goes into World War II with a battle fleet that's primarily old ships that have, you know, the hulls have been around a long time, but they've been upgraded over the years, right? So they have improved, most of them anyway, improved fire control systems. They have more horizontal armor. They are longer range guns. So they've been upgraded. So yes, there has to be some industrial basis. But one of the things that I think is exciting about what the Navy is thinking about now is greater modularity with the platforms so that they can be upgradable as new technologies become available. I think one of the things that the Navy of that time had that we seem to not be as good at today is exploring options relatively quickly, right? So the procurement process now is much more lengthy and risk-averse than century ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what steps need to be taken to make it more agile, but I think that that is something that would be important to look at.
Can you speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book published and how you overcame those?
I will say that the Naval Institute has been great to work with. I've been really impressed with them. But there were challenges before that in terms of, you know, who is the best publisher for this. And I reached out to a number of different organizations and didn't get very far, but I was happy that the Naval Institute was receptive. We felt like this aligned with their mission, and I agreed, so they'll be publishing it.
Okay. What's your next writing project?
I'm actually working on another project for the Naval Institute right now. It's not going to be as lengthy, but it's going to look at the battles off Guadalcanal. It's going to be a an examination of those in some more detail, building off of things from the book and also other things that I've published recently.
I don't know if you saw in the news that I guess the Lexington was just discovered. The shipwreck was just discovered. I'm curious.
Yes, I saw that.
Do you think there's any historical data that could be gathered from it at this point? Or
yeah. I mean, I think there's always value, I think, in assessing the state of some of these wrecks on the bottom, and what can we discern? Because a lot of the damage assessments and control that goes on while you're trying to save the ship is oriented first towards saving the ship, but also may not reveal or be as focused on some of the underwater damage that may have taken place. And so there may be some things that we could glean about Lexington's final hours from the state of the wreck. It's possible. It may not be. But I think that would be worth looking at. I assume that Paul Allen and his team are going to do a survey of the wreckage and hopefully present, you know, visual pictures or maybe even some sort of 3D model of what they find that could be used by those who are good at analyzing wrecks and understanding them.
However, I saw it was going to be declared a grave site, so I don't know how much that restricts the research that can be done on site.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they can't get into it or do any of those things or do anything potentially destructive, but I think if they just photograph all that they can see, that might be worthwhile.
Right.
I mention that because there's the wreck of a number of the different ships that were sunk off Guadalcanal have been found, and some of those have been quite interesting to see their state, to see the damage that is visible. The hull of Kirishima, one of the Japanese battleships, was found, and then unfortunately she is upside down, so it's difficult to see any sort of topside damage, but you can see shell holes in the hull from what is visible.
So where can people find your work?
They can get it from the Naval Institute directly. They have a website, usni.org, that has a book section. It's on there. It's also on Amazon, and I assume it's going to be carried at a variety of other places.
It's being published in June, you said, right?
That's right, June of this year.
And you don't have your own website of any of your naval research, do you?
Oh, I do. No, I have a website that has links to all the different books that I've written, and also a blog that I keep. I haven't had much time to keep it up to date lately, but it does have various thoughts on there. And it's just Trenthone, all one word, so Trenthone, .com.
Okay. Any final thoughts?
Oh, yes. You mentioned when you were asking about concepts for going into World War II, and you had mentioned the Japanese, I talked a lot about the American perspective. I do think that it's useful and interesting to contrast the Japanese perspective, and I'll try to do it succinctly. One of the things that's obvious as the United States Navy was preparing for war is they conceptualized it as a a campaign. The primary focus is a campaign in the Pacific against the Empire of Japan. And the specific means for achieving victory was something that remained a bit amorphous. This is clear not only in the pre-war planning, but also in some of the initial plans that Chester Nimitz, the commander of the Pacific Fleet, develops during the course of the war. So there are different offensive thrusts, and they have to be prepared for the Japanese to come out and fight. But if they don't choose to do so, you know, that's okay. The campaign is the main theme. The Japanese approach is different. They became very focused on a battle. The battle becomes the main thing. And you can see this repeatedly, not only in their pre-war thinking, which unfortunately I haven't had a chance to study in great detail, but I've got some insight into it from what was in the U.S. Navy's records and also has been published in secondary sources. But it happens at Pearl Harbor, right? Pearl Harbor is sort of the, we'll strike this initial decisive blow, and that's a battle. Mm-hmm. It doesn't knock the United States out of the war, but it gives the Japanese freedom for a while. Mm-hmm. And then Midway is, again, conceptualized as a, we will draw out the American fleet and destroy it. Victory through the battle. Mm-hmm. And on through, you know, the battles that make up Leyte Gulf in October 1944. Mm-hmm. So that's a very interesting contrast that I think sometimes is missed. So I just wanted to highlight that.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess that's all I have. So thank you for speaking with me.
Yeah, thank you. This has been very enjoyable.
Thank you for listening. More information can be found at warscholar.org.